I'll call this meeting of the Audit, Compliance, and Title IX Committee to order. Could I have roll call?
Chair Carter?
Here.
Vice Chair Del Carlo? Regent Ariscada? Regent Dubrava? Regent Geddes?
Here.
Regent McMichael?
Here.
You do have a quorum.
Fantastic. We'll move on to item number one, public comment. Do we have any public comment in Elko?
We have no public comment in Elko.
Do we have any public comment in Reno?
There's none here in Reno.
Do we have any public comment in Las Vegas? Seeing none, we will move on to item number two, our consent agenda.
Move approval.
I have a motion. Do I have a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. We'll move on to item number three, Chair's Report. We do have the quality assurance review as item number four, so we'll go in a little bit of detail, but I think that worked out really well. The external reviewer was very interested in how our setup was with the audit committee and the audit auditor, chief auditor reporting to the Board of Regents, and had some interesting insight there, and it was a good experience and report to kind of interact with them. I think that's it. Well, we do have an item a little later from our external auditor that's going to be doing some development with us. Hopefully everyone can join us for that a little bit later in the meeting. With that, we'll move on to item number four, Internal Audit Department Quality Assurance Review. Mr. Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury, Chief Internal Auditor. In the audit summary document, I've included a table of reports being presented today, along with key observations. As always, want to say thank you to the institutions with reports being presented today. I've talked at past meetings about how audit needs to take advantage of technology and increase our collaboration with the institutions. We've done so to complete these audits and these follow-ups going today, so thank you again. And that thank you actually extends really to the whole system as it relates to this first item being presented today. So at previous meetings, I've mentioned Internal Audit's Quality Assurance Review, or QAR. And this QAR really answers the question, who audits the auditors? So very quick background on how this process works. The most cost-effective way to go about this is to utilize materials provided by the Institute of Internal Auditors in line with their international standards for the professional practice of internal auditing. This is a fascinating read, by the way, if anybody'd like a copy or needs a good nap. But essentially, this is what guides our adherence to the mandatory element of our professional framework and establishes the basis on which you can evaluate internal audit performance. And more importantly, in my opinion, it fosters an environment of continuous improvement. It's a great way for us to elevate our performance wherever we can. So that's the self-assessment piece. In terms of results, just a little compare and contrast. 6 years ago when we did this, we actually had two areas of non-conformance noted. And this year, I'm happy to say, we had zero conformance gaps. So I really want to thank my team for their work. They take a lot of pride in what they do, and it shows in those results to get that generally conforms rating. So we took that self-review and coordinated an independent validation. So those validators have their own procedures to get comfortable with our results, our documentation. They dig into our work papers and have a lot of conversations with key stakeholders around the system. Many in this room today participated in that. Thank you again. So what you have in terms of the materials for this agenda item is the combination of those two documents. We did identify a few continuous improvement items. Didn't rise to the level of nonconformance, but we felt it was important enough to include those, again, in the spirit of continuous improvement. I'll stop there if there's any questions. I really could talk about this all day. I'm not even kidding. But any questions, happy to answer. Thank you.
Well, first of all, do we have a motion to accept this report?
Motion to approve.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion or questions for Mr. Sunbury?
Just if Mr. Sunbury wants to talk about that all day, I'll get into the Krebs cycle if you want.
Any other questions or discussion? I think it was a very positive experience. I think we got some good information out of that. Mr. McMichael, did you have a... Okay, just ready to vote. Okay, so I have a motion and a second. So all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion passes. We'll move on to item number 5, change in leadership, UNR, Chief Internal Auditor Joe Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury. The next audit report for you today is change in leadership, UNR. I think everyone on this committee has been through one of these audits before, but again, just as additional background and reminder, so historically, when there's been a change at in institution president, we'll perform what we used to call presidential exit audit. The idea behind these reviews actually came well before my time, but essentially for the sake of the incoming leader, let's have internal audit do a quick review, some standard areas, so that he or she can be assured things are operating as intended, or we'll have an understanding of any areas that might need some attention. And it makes sense. We've talked about how risk levels inherently will increase whenever you see a change in process, a change in system, or a change in people. So these audits historically include things like expenditures review, host operating travel, financial account reviews for deficit balances, review of any legal action, contracts, equipment, that kind of thing. So with that background in mind, for this audit, we have just one minor control improvement suggestion surrounding an after-the-fact purchase order. Thank you.
Do I have a motion to accept this report?
So moved.
So moved.
Second.
We have a second. Any discussion? Questions for Mr. Sunbury? Hearing and seeing none, all in favor of accepting this report, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. We'll move on to number 6, hosting Chief Internal Auditor Joe Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury, Chief Internal Auditor. The Board of Regents Handbook, Title 4, Chapter 10, Section 25, requires that internal audit tests host expenses annually. And the way we've satisfied that requirement in the past is to sample an institution or two on a rotating basis annually. For as deep of a dive as these reviews can be, the results and recommendations are consistent with the last few hosting audits we've presented, which is just a couple of transactions noted with opportunities to improve related to documentation surrounding approval. And the other thing I'd just like to add on this item was that this audit was already in progress by the time we had our September committee meeting. But at that meeting, there was a bit of a light bulb moment when, and I can't remember who mentioned it, but when I was talking about the history, how we typically will pick an institution or two, and that's how we've historically sampled, given the information that we have at our fingertips with Workday, I think you'll start to see some changes in how we do these, a little broader view of the system, a little more compare and contrast, more information that can be sliced and diced, better data visualization, things like that. So just want to say thanks.
I have a motion to accept the audit.
Second.
We have a second. Any discussion or questions for Mr. Sunbury? Agent Geddes.
Yeah, Joe, I guess, can you expand a little bit on what sort of data you think would be coming out of Workday?
Thank you, Regent Geddes. For the record, Joe Sunbury. So I think we've piloted a few items that have come to the board before with good feedback. So, there's types of information. So historically, when we've just done a bit of what I'll call a blind sample, that may hit a number of different departments. But what we can do in Workday is kind of dig a little bit deeper, do compare and contrast, where is a lot of the hosting spending coming from, different departments at given institutions, similar departments across all institutions, things like that. So that's, I think, kind of an example of what I'm getting at.
So, thank you.
Any other questions or discussion? Hearing and seeing none, all in favor of accepting the report, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. Move on to item number 7, communication with those charged with governance. So this is a very important part of our fiduciary duty as regents, and our external auditor performs lots of audits. So the next several items will be from our external auditor.
Good afternoon, everyone. For the record, Kim McCormick. I'm an audit partner with Grant Thornton. Great to be with you all in person here today. We're going to get started with a series of agenda items that talk about a number of audits of INCHI and of related organizations for the fiscal year ended June 30, 21. So we're going to start first talking about the audit of the whole system, the system-wide organization. That's agenda item number 7. And 7 is where I'm going to talk about some of the results of the audit and the areas of focus, and then we'll jump to agenda item number 8, which is actually the financial statements themselves, the final document that will have the auditor's opinion. But let's start with agenda item number 7. Just a reminder to reorient you, the organization undergoes essentially 2 audits. One is of the financial statements, and the second is of the 700 and some odd million dollars worth of federal awards that make their way to ENSHE, and they undergo what's called a uniform guidance audit. It's essentially a compliance audit that the federal government requires of any organization that receives that volume of federal grants and contracts. So we'll be talking about both audits during the course of the discussion today. In the document that's attached to agenda item number 7, we focus on a number of things, but we start just talking about the areas of focus for the financial statement audit. As you might expect, the key revenue drivers, the tuition revenue, the big federal grants and contracts, a big influx of federal pandemic relief money impacted the organization for fiscal 21, and also the other revenue sources. Other big areas of focus are liabilities that sit on your balance sheet, essentially. The PERS, the pension obligation, and then the post-employment benefit obligation. One of the reasons I wanted to highlight the post-retirement benefit obligation, we refer to this sometimes as the PEB liability. On your books, that's a significant number. It's about $606 million liability. And it's one of these interesting numbers where ENSHE is actually reliant on another party to give them, calculate the number for the state, and then say, here is ENSHE's share. So ENSHE has been provided with a number, but part of the process of getting comfortable with the validity of the number is seeing that it was audited. And it just so happens that the audit timing for that PEBS audit was delayed this year. So because of that, while there's a number in the financial statements, management's waiting for that audit to get done to validate it, and then we'll finish our audit accordingly. So agenda item number 7 and 8, the documents in your package are marked draft for that very reason. So that's a little bit unusual this year, but I just wanted to bring that to your attention. We fully expect that when that audit's complete, we'll be issuing an unqualified opinion, unmodified opinion that the financial statements are fairly stated. We do have a handful of internal control recommendations that we'll get to in the next agenda item with respect to that financial statement audit. So let's talk about the federal compliance audit. This year, there were a lot of programs that met the criteria to be audited. I mentioned that $700 million figure. That's the total federal awards for the year. Roughly half of that is your student financial assistance program, so the Pell Grants and the student loans. That usually meets the criteria to audit every year, and this year was no different. But the second largest program was one of these federal pandemic relief funds. It's the Higher Education Emergency Relief Fund. Sometimes we refer to it as the acronym HERF. So that is monies that some were received and spent in 20, a big chunk in fiscal 21, and you have some more to spend for your fiscal 22. But the spending for your fiscal 21 represented 17% of all your federal awards for the year. So it was a big program. You had a lot of latitude in how it was spent, and every school received the money. So therefore, it was a very big program that needed to be audited this year. All in, there were 5 federal programs that met the criteria to be audited this year. The federal government essentially selects which ones meet the criteria by virtue of a formula. The other programs that were audited were the Coronavirus Relief Fund. These are also pandemic relief monies that actually go through state agencies before they make their way here to ENSHE. Sometimes they go through the county before they make their way here. And then the other programs were the Large Research and Development Cluster and then the Adult Education Program. Across the board, each audit resulted in a clean opinion. So congratulations to you all for that good result. There were a handful of findings that are a byproduct of that audit. We'll talk about that in the next agenda item as well. So I guess I'd like to wrap up by, this agenda item by just, thanking the finance teams, Rep Virtues at the system office, who essentially serves as air traffic control for the whole audit, the controllers at all the schools, the student financial aid administrators, and all those in charge of federal programs. Also, we received some assistance from Mr. Sunbury's internal audit department, and we thank them as well. So happy to answer any questions before we move on to agenda item number 8.
Are there any questions right now for item number 7 before we go to number 8 to actually look at the numbers? Seeing and hearing none, number 7 was for information only, so we'll move on to item number 8, Uniform Guidance Audit Report and Financial Statements.
Okay, so agenda item number 8 is the actual financial statements of the system for the year. This is a big sprawling document. It's 230 pages long. I'm sure you read every word of it in preparation for the meeting today, but its basic structure is that it starts, one of the very first pages is our opinion that those financial statements are fairly stated in all material respects. It's followed by a section called Management's Discussion and Analysis, which is if there's a piece of the document you're going to read, it's nice, easy, friendly to read. Talks about trends from one year to the next. It's followed by the formal financial statements, the footnotes to the financial statements, and then a great big supplemental schedule called the Schedule of Expenditure of Federal Awards. Sometimes we refer to that as the CEFA. That's 120 pages of the document, and that $700 million of federal awards that I mentioned, every single one of those awards is listed in that document. It's actually the starting point of the compliance audit that we conduct. And then if, to the extent there's any findings that we report in the context of the audit, those are listed at the very back of the document. So I did want to highlight for you, mentioned a moment ago, there were some findings. They'll start on page 209 and 231 of the document. The first two internal control comments relate to the financial statement audit. We had a recommendation about validating the fair value of some of the investment portfolio that shows on the balance sheet of the organization, particularly that piece of the investment portfolio we call alternative investments, where it's not as easy as going to a traded exchange to get comfort with the fair value. There's other procedures that management has to conduct to get comfortable with the fair value. At June 30, the system had roughly 90 of these alternative investments. They're very common. We see them in higher education all the time. But it is a bit cumbersome gathering all the information to kick the tires and get comfortable with the fair value. So from a process standpoint, we noticed that that process of getting comfortable with the valuation, it was delayed, and there was a fair amount of last-minute effort gathering all the inputs to get comfortable. In the end, management was comfortable, as were we, but we thought there was an opportunity for process improvement there. Our second comment actually relates to that big schedule of expenditures of federal awards, that 200-page document, the $700 million. That is a schedule that's required by the federal government. They're quite specific. They have a lot of rules about how it's structured and how awards are grouped. And we noticed a couple of instances where awards were put in one category versus the other. And our recommendation there is that it might be a good opportunity to have a refresh of training for all the individuals who are involved in gathering the information to populate that document, just to make sure that all the federal government's rules are being adhered to. So that was the second comment. We're going to move now to the findings for the Uniform Guidance Audit. So this is the federal award audit. The findings really squarely fell into one federal program, the Student Financial Assistance Program. For those of you who are veterans on the audit committee, you'll recognize that there have been findings, some historical findings there over the last several years. The types of findings, compliance findings that we reported were all repeat type findings. There was nothing new. I would say on average, the number of findings have gone down, which is positive. And there were a couple of findings from last year that were actually remediated that didn't repeat. So that was a good step forward. Again, our opinion on this program was clean. It was unmodified, but there are areas for improvement in a couple of the areas. Student financial assistance is everyone in the management team knows here's a very complicated program. There's lots of rules to adhere to. And when the government provides us with the audit guide of what they'd like us to test, they really have us go pretty deep in some of these areas. So our findings are listed here. Management's corrective action plans are included in this document. And then the whole package, once complete, actually gets filed with the federal government so they can see the progress since last year. So that really wraps up what I wanted to comment on this agenda item. Again, happy to answer any questions.
First, like a motion to accept the audit. We have a motion.
Motion to accept.
Motion. We have a second from Regent Del Carlo. Any questions? Chief Internal Auditor Joe Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. Joe Sunbury for the record. Not so much a question, but just to kind of pile on what Kim had said. You know, I have the pleasure. I don't know if it's a pleasure for me. I don't know if it's a pleasure for them. But I sit in with the financial aid directors quarterly, and so this is really a lot of these things are on their radar. And I just, for the record, I kind of went back a decade, and fiscal year 11, we actually had 27 control deficiencies total within our overall audit. And that remained in the teens for a while. So to Kim's point, just wanted to provide a little more quantitative number to that. But so a lot of improvements have been made. Obviously, still work to do, but we're trending the right way. So I just wanted to get that on the record. Thanks.
I have a question, it's a question. So on the fair evaluation of alternative investments, we kind of talked about that a little bit when we had our pre-briefing. But for the benefit of the board, could you maybe give an example of how that works in another institution?
Yes, Kim McCormick for the record. As I mentioned, it's not at all unusual in higher education for the investment portfolio to include what we call alternative investments. That's nothing more than an investment that's not traded on exchange, like a share in IBM, for example. What it is instead is INSHE owns a portion, usually of a partnership or an LLC. It might be 0.002%, and you're one of many, many different limited partners. And so what those the general partners in those partnerships do is they submit valuation data to Nevada System and say, here you go, here's what your piece of the pie is. But it hasn't been validated in any way, and it's not like you can easily go to an exchange to evaluate it because it's not a traded security, if you will. So what INSHE does and what other organizations do is try to anchor something about that partnership that has been validated, and usually that is the annual financial statement audit of that partnership. And if you can validate that number by looking at their audited statement, take your piece of the pie, 0.02% or whatever it is, generally you can get pretty close to what your valuation is. Sometimes the timing is different, their audits as of December and your audits as of June, but there's a way to bridge the gap. And the whole idea is, if they're providing you a figure, does it stand the test of their own audit, and can you basically come up with the same figure? And that gives you some extra comfort that the valuation that they're providing with to you is accurate.
Are there any other questions or discussion? Hearing none and seeing none, all in favor of accepting the audit, say aye.
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 Any opposed?
Aye.
Hearing none, we'll move on to item number 9, communications with those charged with governance, University of Nevada, Reno School of Medicine, Integrated Clinical Services.
All right, very good. So agenda item 9 is specific to the audit of Integrated Clinical Services, which is the medical practice plan associated with University of Nevada, Reno. This entity undergoes an annual financial statement audit. It actually is consolidated up as a component unit into the full system audit that we just talked about, but it also has a stand-alone audit. So areas of focus for this audit are going to be what you expect. It's all about the patient revenue, the patient receivables, the collectability of those patient receivables. And this year, given that there was a transaction after the end of the fiscal year with Renown about how that program is going to be run, there's some new disclosures in the financial statements that, talk about that, that transition. This audit went well. It's also a clean opinion. Last year, we had reported an internal control finding with respect to some what were rather stale amounts owed to, former patients, and, there was the, process of working those down and repaying them or escheating them was, going rather slow. This year, we were satisfied that enough action and remediation was underway where we didn't feel compelled to repeat it as a finding this year. So I know those balances are still being worked, but the process seems very organized and far far along. So congrats for that positive movement there. That's really what I wanted to mention for ICS.
Any questions or comments on item number 9 before we get to the financial statements item 10? Hearing none and seeing none, that was for information only, so we'll go on to item number 10, financial statements.
All right, item number 10 is the financial statements themselves. They're structured in much the same way as the structure for the Nevada system financial statement. Similar to Nevada system, to the extent that there are findings to report, those are in the very back of the report, page 42 of 42. There were no findings for fiscal 21. So again, congrats for that good result. And on page 42, there's just a summary of the, current status of what we reported as a finding in the prior year. And as I mentioned, that was far enough in the remediation process where we didn't feel compelled to repeat it again as a finding this year. So congrats for, a good result for ICS.
Do you have a motion to accept the UNR ICS financial statements audit? Jim Del Carlo, and then we had a second from...
Second.
A second from Michael. Any discussion or questions?
Question?
Oh, there we go. Virginia Riscata.
In regards to the accrued liability from June 30th of 2020 till today, is it projected to go increase, decrease?
Well, I think the, projection is that it's going to decrease as, patients are repaid or the, amounts are sheeted. I'll defer to the, management team to talk about the, current status of it. I am not aware.
Future. That'll be fine. Oh, Mr. Redding, please.
Good morning. For the record, Vic Redding, Vice President, Administration and Finance for the University of Nevada, Reno, and Regent Ariscotta, absolutely correct. As we work our way through those, settling those stale patient balances that will eventually go to zero or an immaterial write-off number, as part of the transition to Renown, that will remain our responsibility to settle out. It didn't transition to Renown, so it is ours to settle. But it is on track to be completed over the next several months. The older these accounts get, the harder they are, of course, to settle out. So we continue to monitor that from an operational perspective.
Exactly what I was looking for. Thank you.
Any other questions or discussion? Hearing none and seeing none, we have a motion and a second. So all in favor say say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
Hearing none, we'll move on. That motion passes, and we'll move on to item number 11, communications of those charged with governance, University of Nevada, Las Vegas, Medicine.
Very good. Kim McCormick with Grant Thornton for the record. So in agenda item number 11, the discussion is about the audit of UNLV medicine. So the practice plan for UNLV also has a standalone audit and also gets rolled up in the consolidation for the system. These results are for the standalone audit. In terms of areas of focus, very similar to what I just mentioned for integrated clinical service. The biggest area of focus is about the patient revenue, the collectability, and the reserve setting process. During the course of this audit, there was an error in the calculation for the allowance for doubtful accounts on the patient's receivable that came to our attention during the course of the audit. And it was significant enough. It was roughly $1.3 million where the financial statements needed to be adjusted to reflect that correction. Management was in agreement that correction needed to be made, so it's reflected in the financial statements. That's one of the things that we are required to point out to you as part of these communications, and that is on page 10 of 42 of the document. So after having booked that entry, we thought the financial statements were fairly stated, and we have rendered a clean opinion on those financial statements as well. One thing that I'll mention about UNLV Medicine that's interesting for this year is that they're also a recipient of federal pandemic relief funds in a couple different forms, but it just so happens that the threshold for needing one of these uniform guidance single audits was hit in fiscal 21. So UNLV Medicine will be undergoing its first single audit. That's something that's still ahead of us. It's actually scheduled for the next couple weeks. There's one program, there'll be one major program that meets the criteria to test. It's a Department of Health and Human Services, HRSA, award for testing and vaccines for the uninsured. So we have that ahead of us, and we look forward to reporting results out to you when that audit is complete. So that really wraps up my comments for agenda item number 11. Unless there's any questions, I'm happy to move on to agenda item number 12.
Any questions on item number 11 before we move on to financial statements? Hearing none and seeing none, that was for information only, so we'll move on to item number 12, financial statements.
All right, so for agenda item number 12, as you might expect, we're now to the financial statements themselves for UNLV Medicine. Again, structure very similar to the other entities, and our opinion on those financial statements is a clean opinion that we believe they're fairly stated in all material respects. So thank you for the hard work for UNLV Medicine staff to get to that place. I mentioned in the last agenda item that there was a correction that was necessary to some of the figures to make those financial statements fairly stated. And in light of that, we have reported a finding with respect to the internal control process that ideally can be fine-tuned so errors like that are identified and corrected in the normal course versus being corrected in the or identified and corrected in the audit process. So our finding is on page 38 of 39 of the document, and it really summarizes a little bit of the background of what issues gave rise to that $1.3 million understatement of the allowance for doubtful accounts. It was a combination of two issues. One was a formula error in Excel, and the other was a data input error. In terms of the actual calculation. And the combination of those two things resulted in the understatement. So it was identified during the process. It's corrected, and that is the important thing. Prospectively, our recommendation is that the supervisory review on that calculation just be a little bit more robust so those types of issues are noted in the normal course. So that wraps up the comments for UNLV Medicine.
Do I have a motion to accept this audit? So moved by Regent Del Carlo,
second
by Regent McMichael. Any questions or discussion? Hearing none and seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
Motion passes on item number 12. Thank you so much, Ms. McCormick.
My pleasure.
Now we're going to go on to item 13, Audit Compliance and Title IX Committee Development. So we've asked Grant Thornton to come back with Matt Unterman and Matt Lerner presenting on risk management. A lot of what our audit committee tries to do is to audit things that have risk or try to help come up with processes or evaluate processes that try to eliminate risk. So this would be a very valuable presentation for us. So all yours, Matt.
All right. I'm taking my watch off so I can be conscious of time. Matt Unterman, for the record, Grant Thornton. You may remember me as the guy who came to the last meeting and showed a great deal of passion for what's happening in the state of higher education. I think I covered over 70 slides in 45 minutes. I think that was a record pace. I'm sorry to disappoint you at this meeting. We only have 30 minutes, so it's a different competition today, but we are covering a number of slides on a topic that we do care equally passionately about, which is enterprise risk management. Enterprise risk management, we're going to go through a definition, how it applies to higher education, and some things that you may be considering about across the overall system. Next slide, please. I'll be joined in a couple minutes by Matt Lerner, who is the lead of our risk advisory services for a higher education practice. I'm assuming the green button. Matt leads our risk management practice for higher education. You'll hear from him directly. All right. This is one of the main slides that we covered last time. This is what's happening in higher education, a number of things that many institutions are considering. You may recall that enterprise risk management was number 3 on this list. It's what we're talking about today. If you'd like in the future, we'd love the opportunity to come back and talk to you about anything else on this list or things that are on your mind. So again, today we're going to be talking about defining risk and enterprise risk management. We're talking about the process of performing ERM, how ERM applies to higher education, what COVID did to ERM. We'll have some time for wrap-up and Q&A at the end, if appropriate. So defining risk in ERM. So you're all familiar with risk management, and most of you, if not all of you, are already familiar with ERM. I think one of the interesting things about enterprise risk management for me is it talks about both what we are traditionally familiar with in risk, which is the downside of risk. Cybersecurity, what happens if financials fall, et cetera. But ERM is also focused on the upside of risk. What happens if we don't capitalize on the opportunities that the market presents to us? COVID, as an example, of course, we're very familiar with the downside of COVID, but there are things that provided opportunities, and not seizing those opportunities would be something that we'd want to focus on holistically from an enterprise risk management perspective as well. So this slide covers a little bit about COSO's framework for ERM. And ERM simply stated it's a process to determine which risks could impact your institution's ability to achieve its mission, as well as its key strategies and objectives. Again, there's the upside and that downside included in that same statement. ERM is really in service of strategy. It's informed by and informs strategy, both directions. It helps organizational decision making. I'm going to focus on the last bolded words up top. It has a purpose of managing risk in creating, preserving, and realizing value. So it's meant to be holistic in its nature over risk management. We have on the left the COSO Cube. Okay, many of you are familiar with that. It has its 8 different evaluation areas on the front, the 4 risk categories on the top, and the 4 different levels on the side. All of that complete covers the things that we consider from risk management and from ERM. And on the right, it presents the fact that ERM is really inclusive and related to many different items of risk management: compliance, internal controls, internal audit, cybersecurity, insurance. They're all really related from a holistic risk management perspective. This slide is from the IIA, the Institute of Internal Auditors. It's called the 3 lines model. We won't go into the details here of what those 3 lines are, but the whole concept of ERM is it's meant to establish a risk management culture across the institution. It's meant to establish a sense of inclusivity of we're all responsible for risk management. This isn't just a CFO's responsibility or a legal officer's responsibility. This is everyone's responsibility. And these 3 lines underscore many, many different constituents across an institution are responsible for reporting up and assisting. ERM, again, being holistic, has many different activities, which are represented up top in the purple boxes. They also have many different values of risk management because of all those different, of enterprise risk management, because of all those different activities. It looks at risk impacts, it looks at controls, et cetera, et cetera. And as we look at the value drivers of ERM, the value drivers, again, we see on that upside and that downside basis. We see things like looking at establishing a risk culture, holistic over all this. We see a linkage to strategic planning, which has the upside opportunity, increasing constituent confidence, that's the upside. And of course, managing the downside does the same thing, right? Improving our cybersecurity, improving our disaster recovery, all these different elements help to improve from a value perspective, okay? ERM is really a platform for discussions about risk. It's, again, as I said, is about establishing a culture, and it's an enabling an inclusive concept of who manages risk across the whole organization. I'm going to turn it over to Matt, who will continue our presentation.
Thank you, Matt. For the record, Matt Lerner, Grant Thornton. I want to talk a little bit about some of the deliverables and give you a quick overview of maybe some of the nuts and bolts, if you will, of ERM and how it works and what some of the outputs are. You can see here the ongoing ERM cycle, and really that key takeaway is that ERM is something that is ongoing in nature. It's not intended to be performed at a point in time and then sit on the shelf. There are a number of processes that Matt spoke to, the other Matt spoke to earlier, that are a part of that, including identifying what your key enterprise risks are, prioritizing and evaluating them, understanding what risk mitigation strategies we're putting in place to diminish those risks, and then reporting and monitoring and making sure that we have the appropriate controls and reporting associated with those. But again, the key takeaway is that this goes, this occurs on an ongoing basis throughout the year. Here you see a sampling of some material risk categories, how we categorize risk. It's really intended to be holistic in nature. It covers strategy, technology, financial risks, compliance. We'll talk a little bit more about this as I talk you through some of the risk taxonomy and the risk register as we inventory our risks. This is a little bit of a deeper dive, an example of financial risks and how we get from that higher level material risk category to the principal level and then really down into that subcomponent or sub-risk level. And really what this is aimed at doing is making sure that we are holistic in our thinking about some of the key enterprise risks that an institution may be facing. Here's a glossary of some key terms. We'll be using some of these as we move forward today. I'm sure you're familiar with impact and likelihood. Those are really the primary attributes by which we prioritize enterprise risks. We'll talk a little bit more about inherent and residual risk and the importance of that in just a moment. And then noted at the bottom of the page here are what we call secondary attributes, velocity, duration, and trend. Velocity being the speed with which an impact is felt when a risk event occurs. Duration is how long we feel or experience that impact once an event occurs. And then trend is really just a directional understanding. Are we expecting this risk to increase in the future, decrease, or stabilize? So speaking more to inherent versus residual risk, inherent risk is the risk that does not take into consideration or before taking into consideration any of the risk mitigation activities that we may have in place to reduce those risks today. Residual risk is taking a prioritization or an evaluation after taking into consideration those risk mitigation plans that we have in place, but it does not typically take into consideration any future planned risk mitigations that we may be putting into place in the future. So here we're talking about, this is really a risk evaluation framework, if you will, or a risk scoring framework. The details are less important, but really what's the important takeaway here is that we think holistically about risk when we're evaluating the impact. Because risk is multifaceted, it's multidimensional. It can manifest in any number of ways. When a risk occurs, it may not just impact our reputation or present a legal or regulatory risk. We really want to think about it categorically and say, what's the impact to our strategy, to our financials, to our operations? So thinking about it broadly and having both quantitative and qualitative measures that allow us to really think about and prioritize that risk in and amongst the universe of other risks that we're considering. Similarly, here's a likelihood or frequency scale. We usually use a 5-point scale here, really just understanding how we think about the likelihood of or the probability of that risk occurring. Here's the application of that in a risk register or a risk taxonomy. There's a lot here on the page, but you can see how, as we think about impact, it's taking into consideration strategy, operations, legal risks, and the like. And as we get into the next slide here, perhaps a bit more readable, we have our risk description. So it's important how we identify and describe our risk, and then our inherent and residual risk scores. This is really how we understand residual risk. And what we cover here is our current risk mitigation strategies, as well as our additional action items that we'll be covering. So really, this serves as a roadmap for future risk mitigation, ownership, and how we consider and reduce risk going forward. Here's an application of that in a heat map, visual representation. What I like most about this is that it allows you to really see the movement or the impact of our risk mitigation plans. So what you're seeing here is our inherent risk ratings. And then as we move forward, you see, hopefully over time, we're moving from that top right quadrant down to more of the lower left as we mitigate all of these risks. So I wanted to talk a little bit about ERM in higher education, what we're seeing across the industry in ERM. This is really talking about what we see as high-value ERM, how we really try to reinforce the success of an ERM program in an institution. One is that really keeping it simple is critical to success. Focusing on fewer risks of greater importance, more significance when it comes to gains or losses, that downside and upside that Matt Unterman spoke to earlier. It's really about optimizing risk or optimizing value, rather than trying to manage risk down to zero. So a little different than perhaps your traditional view of risk management. It's really something that's intended to be integrated into strategic decision-making, our operations. It's not something that is set to the side and occurring in a silo. You really want it to be integrated with your processes, with your strategy. I'll talk a little bit more about a case study a little later on of how institutions are doing that. And most importantly, perhaps, is that it requires a cultural change, typically, in an institution to understand that this is important work. It is in service of the strategic objectives and the mission of the institution. And therefore, we hope that it, and when it is most successful, it is embedded in the culture of the organization. Here's the current state of ERM and higher education. Generally speaking, there is a broad spectrum of ERM maturity across higher education. Some have had programs in place for many years, very focused on sort of higher level activities, data analytics, quantitative measurements of risk, whereas others are really just getting started or perhaps don't even have an ERM program in place at all. But generally speaking, as an industry, probably a bit behind for-profits, particularly financial services and whatnot, who have been doing this for many, many years. But there really is a benefit to institutions in having increased focus on those strategic risks as opposed to a pure focus on more operational process-level risk. Some best practices here to get started on an ERM journey, if you will. I talked about earlier a little bit about the importance of really just keeping it simple, starting small, walk before you run, if you will, focusing on a more limited number of risks and doing a bit of a pilot to get started. I've seen a lot of institutions struggle with ERM when they try and take on too much too soon, and it either ends up failing or being challenging or taking up way more resources than they originally anticipated. That's not really the intent of ERM. I want it to be value add, manageable, and something you can build upon in the future. Here's just a representation of, there are many different ways to do ERM. There's no one right way to do so. There's a number of different ways. And here just talks about that pilot process that I talked about. And for institutions that don't have an ERM program in place today, starting small and building upon that is really the best way to get started. If you do have an ERM program, continuous improvement is something that we strive for, building our capabilities month over month, year over year, in order to, you know, you want to have your desired future state. You may not get there right away, but building in data analytics, more quantitative measures of risk, some higher order activities, if you will, over time. Here's just a slide that talks a little bit about the roles and responsibilities between management and the board. Simply stated, management typically owns and implements ERM with periodic reporting to a board or an audit committee most often, particularly focused on the areas of greatest risk to an institution, with the board's role, of course, being one of oversight, one of making sure that management is shepherding the ERM process and holding them accountable for the management of those key risks across the institution. I spoke about some of the common risk areas earlier, so I'm going to jump right into this, which is really just intended to say, again, reinforce, higher education institutions are complex entities. There's a lot going on. You know, this is just a small sample of what a risk universe could look like for an institution. So it can be a lot to manage, hence the, you know, the suggestion earlier, start small, focus on what you consider to be your highest risks, and then build upon it from there. And this is really just a little preview or summary of some of the key risks that we see a lot of our higher education clients talking about. Obviously, COVID-19 and return to campus and all of the ancillary items related to that, impacts on student mental health, online and hybrid learning models, and the like. But also things, other items like diversity, equity, and inclusion, new NCAA regulations related to name, image, and likeness, Title IX, of course, and foreign influence on research. These are all common topics that present risks as well as opportunities to institutions that are on the minds of many of our clients. So with that, I'm going to turn it back to Matt.
Wonderful. Matt Unterman, Grant Thornton, for the record. I think just to underscore one important point that Matt Lerner mentioned on his prior slides. So you saw this very detailed slides, many, many, many risks. As you know, higher education institutions are incredibly complex. But then Matt is then saying, walk before you run. And one of the challenges that we've seen in higher education as ERM became more and more commonplace within the industry, at the beginning, there was a sense of trying to be inclusive with every risk possible, okay? And then we entered into just too many risks, and we had to boil the ocean from all those risks. There, now we're at a trend towards trying to focus on our highest risks. Then we enter into the COVID-19 arena, in which this is really a black swan event. A black swan event is when it has extremely high impact, but very low probability. And so while we're trying to focus on the highest, most probabilistic risks that have a high impact, we also need to be inclusive of those things that come out of a different arena and really knock us out, just like COVID-19 did. So I think COVID, as I said before, had its upsides and its downsides, clearly many, many downsides, and we've been focused on that in terms of how to keep our students safe, how to manage our reputations. But from an upside perspective, we have seen many different trends as well. Students that would have gone out of state to other institutions decided to stay closer to home, stay being educated within their state. Now we have an opportunity, an upside, to claim those enhanced brands, those enhanced catchment areas, and decide how do we kind of seize that as an opportunity. Of course, never would we have wished for this to have happened the last couple of years, but we have to respect the ERM and its upside and downside basis. It also causes us to think about what other black swans may be out there. Maybe not high probability, but high impact. Thinking about climate change and whatnot that kind of falls into that bucket. But it also is inclusive of those things that are high probability and high impact. Cyber attacks, et cetera, enrollment cliff. So I think this section just talks about kind of the things that COVID has taught us in ERM. And you'll see a lot of these questions here on the screen. These are questions that we're having to consider due to the pandemic. These really are, in a way, strategic planning questions. which underscores the point that ERM is really informed by and informs strategy. What is the next potential existential risk that we should be prepared for? How do I best serve my mission given the risk environment? What new information do I need to consider to make strategic business decisions? Again, the whole concept of ERM is creating a risk culture, enabling and activating the entire campus and all of our stakeholders to thinking about risk and being very inclusive when it comes to considering the upsides and downsides that ERM can help us to mitigate. What we've seen, and we've mentioned this a couple of times already, inside of higher education, incredibly complex environments. In fact, much more complex than many for-profit environments, frankly. ERM has helped us to manage downside risk, okay? It's also helped us to manage upside risk. So downside risk, again, things like cyber happening, shoring up our perimeters, okay? It's also helped us to think about technologies that we needed to put in place in order to better manage the COVID-19 and tracing our students and potential exposures on campus. All of this should and has been incorporated within ERM in higher education. On the upside, again, I've already mentioned a couple instances that this has caused us to think about. Again, it's a little delicate to use this phrase, but the concept of silver linings. Every bad event has a silver lining, every cloud has a silver lining, and thinking about what has caused us to think about the operational opportunities and financial sustainability that we've been able to navigate successfully through this crisis. What have we learned from that we can infuse into our future strategies? This is, in my mind, the true upside that we need to consider through ERM and through COVID-19. So what's next? It's hard to know what's next. But as we think about what's next, we need to think about those downside and the upside opportunities. COVID, of course, is not complete. We've gone through Return to Campus Part 2. We're still dealing with this through this entire academic year and likely beyond. But it gives us a focus. It gives us a focus on risk. We are not, we're incredibly justified in trying to protect our students and keep risk at the forefront. It's also allowed us to have conversations about these black swan events that maybe aren't high probability, but are important for us to talk about in terms of what our response might be. Okay. I turn it to Matt to talk about a quick case study, and then we'll wrap it up and hopefully have some conversation.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Lerner, Grant Thornton for the record. So I was talking earlier about starting small, right, building incrementally in your ERM program. This case study really talks about some of those next order activities and how ERM can be embedded or integrated with other elements, other operational areas of the institution to really help drive additional value. And this is really about risk-based budgeting, which is really embedding risk in a budgeting process to find and understand as we look for efficiencies in our budgeting model and financially across an institution, what are the risks associated with doing so? And having that be one of the lenses that's employed as we look for those efficiencies, making sure we're thinking holistically, again, downside and upside. What are the risks to what we're looking to do if we are making reductions or perhaps even if we're supplementing budgets in particular areas? So again, it's a great opportunity to embed ERM in the not only the strategy, but some of the operational areas and ultimately the decision-making and the thinking of individuals across the institution. You know, we talked about it being a cultural activity as much as it is, you know, sort of an operational or a compliance activity. This is a great example of how that can drive additional value for an institution. These are really just some of the key outputs there related to that, but I think we covered it, but can really add a lot of value through a bit more of a quantitative or analytical lens to the budgeting process. I'm going to turn it back to Matt for some wrap-up.
Great. Matt Unterman, Grant Thornton for the record. Thank you once again for the opportunity to present on this topic. Sorry to disappoint you. We only did 42 slides in 30 minutes this time. But we try to compress an entire IIA manual and COSO manual into 40 short slides. And of course, there's a lot more to cover in ERM in this short period. These slides are fairly dense. The whole idea was to give you content. Hopefully this is helpful to you. Hopefully it stimulates conversation. potentially now or back at everyone's respective campuses. I'd like to just come back to the same slide that we covered in the presentation from your last meeting. We're seeing a lot change in higher education. I dare say in the last 2 years, last 5 years, has changed so much more in higher education than the last 50. We are seeing the opportunity to go online and serve more students, to think about opportunities of really what it means to educate within our states, not just typical 18 to 22-year-olds, but holistically, who are we as higher education institutions to really be educational institutions to serve our populations. Of course, these are complex entities, challenging environments. Without COVID, we're having challenges about rising costs and increased focus on the value of education. These are some of the things that we're seeing many, many institutions focus on, thinking about how we did addressing COVID, how we're still doing addressing COVID, how are we doing in terms of our reserves, our fund balances, are we efficient from an operational perspective, are we shoring up our cyber perimeters and investing in IT appropriately, or do we have deferred maintenance on that? Are we striking the balance from a downside and upside perspective? Not coincidentally, the language that we continue to use today, thinking about how are we doing in terms of serving our mission? Are we optimizing that? ERM is one small part of that. So I hope this conversation today has been helpful, maybe stimulate some dialogue. I think we have 5 more minutes in our allotted 30 for some Q&A if people are interested in connecting. Thank you.
Thank you both. Any questions or discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I may.
Regent Boylan.
Thank you for that presentation. It's really impressive. Let me ask Matt, the Matt with the hair. You and I both don't have it, so. Yeah, you mentioned something about changing culture. Could you give us a quick who, what, where, when, why? What do you mean when you say that changing the culture? Is that higher education? Is that an institution? Just something briefly. Very impressive, thank you, because I'm involved with something like this myself, so I like it. Thank you. Go ahead.
Great. Oh, thank you, and thank you for having us. Matt Lerner, Grant Thornton, for the record. So when we're talking about culture change, I mean, it certainly can be something that's applied across higher education, but was really talking about within an institution. As we embed ERM, Matt Unterman mentioned the importance of having, you know, the principle, the philosophy, if you will, is that everyone's a risk manager, right? It's if you see something, say something type of thing. So that sometimes requires a change in thinking for individuals, particularly those who don't necessarily have that mindset on a day-to-day basis. You know, it could be in some of the academic areas of the institution and things like that. Everybody manages risk on a daily basis, but they might not even recognize that they're doing so. So being intentional about and how we think and talk about risk and how we think about the impacts of decisions that we're making, that's the kind of culture change that I'm referring to. And it really starts, the recognition of that really starts at the top of an institution, generally speaking, you know, from the top down to say that this is important to us. This is a strategic exercise, and how we think in this way is really going to help guide us to the future. I hope that's helpful.
Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair Carter. I also thank you, Chair Carter, for with your association as the chair of this committee, knowing that this is a product that they offered us. I think it's very, very helpful. I have appreciated all the slides, and hopefully we're going to be putting together a strategic planning committee later in the day, and I can see some of our work's already been done. I mean, those slides on the state of higher ed in 2021. I mean, you've done part of our work for us, so I think it's a great way we're leveraging with you, and it's all symbiotic and together. So thank you for helping us.
Okay. Thank you. I'm glad it's helpful.
Regent Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along the same questions as my fellow regent, I was looking at the new and emerging enterprising risks on one of your slides. How can you give me an example of how diversity, equity, and inclusion is one of those risks?
Absolutely. A great example of a risk and an opportunity, for sure. It can manifest as a risk if an institution doesn't have enough focus on what is a really, you know, critical initiative, you know, across society, and thinking about the reputational impacts, for example, that not having a DE&I strategy may have. Now, as an opportunity, you know, absolutely as well, you know, opportunities for growth, for equality, and just better serving our communities.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Hearing none and seeing none. Thank you so much. Appreciate, and it's nice to see you actually in person and here with us. But we really appreciate that presentation, and we hope to go down that list and do a few more, hopefully, over the next year. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll move on to item number 14, new business. Do I have any new business? Hearing none and seeing none. We'll move on to item number 15, public comment. Do we have any public comment in Elko?
We have no public comment in Elko.
Do we have any public comment in Reno?
There is no public comment in Reno.
Do we have any public comment in Las Vegas? This is audit committee. The full board will meet in just a little bit. So I didn't know if this was related to audit or if you wanted to present to the full board at the regular meeting.
It relates to Title IX, sir.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Please proceed.
My name is Addison Sorka, CSUN Center for the Howard R. Hughes College of Engineering and resident of District 7. As a Title IX committee, I just wanted to comment on my personal experience regarding how UNLV has handled cases relating to sexual assault and harassment. Back in September, my partner was sexually assaulted by an individual who lives on the same on-campus complex as her. It later came out that this was not the first time this individual faced sexual harassment allegations. When she contacted Title IX to see what could be done about it, the best they could offer was a no-contact order and the equivalent of a verbal warning if she wasn't willing to go through the hearing process. They also straight up told her that her case, most likely, would not be serious enough to result in any form of disciplinary action against the student that assaulted her, which is absurd. The whole reason Title IX offers a hearing process is to give students an opportunity to have someone trustworthy investigate the situation. So why would you dissuade someone from having their situation investigated? What this tells me is that UNLV does not care about resolving cases and bringing abusers to justice, but rather getting victims to shut up as quickly as possible and sweeping allegations under the rug. This is an isolated case either. A couple weeks ago, a student organization went before the Senate to request funding and was rejected because members had a history of sexually assaulting several individuals, including a member of the CSUN Senate. One of the excuses the student organization gave, by the way, was that the fraternity members in question had been cleared by the Office of Student Conduct and Title IX. This has left victims not only dissatisfied with UNLV administration at the lack of accountability, but fearful of repeat incidences and retribution, fearful to leave their dorms in case they run into the individual in question, and fearful of a university culture that would allow such incidents to happen. I understand that the body has not had the best record when it comes to harassment, but I plead to this committee and the Greater Board of Regents that some action be taken so that students can trust that the Office of Student Conduct and Title IX will take appropriate action in the future. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any other public comment in Las Vegas? Is that... Hearing none, seeing none, this meeting